This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
It is my great pleasure, as always, to welcome you to this installment of the Chancellor's Colloquium Distinguished Speaker Series. We are now in our fifth season, and the Colloquium Series continues the work of inviting public figures to our campus, renowned researchers and creative artists, to engage us all as a community in compelling conversations around pressing issues for the university of the 21st century. As in the past, our distinguished speakers this year encourage us to take a fresh look at the university as an incubator for innovation and help us reinvigorate our land-grant mission in a more global context. We are very fortunate today to have with us choreographer Stephen Petronio, an artist in residence at the Mandavi Center, whose dance company will be performing this Friday at 8 p.m. in Jackson Hall. So at this point, allow me to introduce David Beal, the director of the UC Davis Humanities Institute, and the Emmanuel Ringenblum, Distinguished Professor of History, who will introduce Stephen Petronio, as well as our moderator, Provost Ralph Hexter. Again, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us here this afternoon for the conversation with Stephen Petronio. Before I introduce our program, I just want to remind everyone to turn off your cell phones, and please note the exits nearest to you in case of emergency. Now, our format this evening will begin with opening remarks by Stephen entitled Confessions of a Motion Addict, followed by a discussion with Provost and Executive Vice Chancellor Ralph Hexter. Then the audience will be given an opportunity to ask their own questions of Stephen Petronio, moderated by Provost Hexter. Allow me first to introduce our moderator, Provost Ralph Hexter. Provost Hexter is a distinguished scholar in classics and comparative literature, and is an academic leader. He has made it a priority to foster excellence across the full range of disciplines and to promote equal opportunity, diversity, and inclusion for students, faculty, and staff. I'm now honored to introduce our distinguished guest, a very talented dancer and choreographer, Stephen Petronio. For nearly 30 years, Stephen has honed a unique language of movement that speaks to the intuitive and complex possibilities of the body within the shifting sphere of our current time. Stephen received a BA from Hampshire College, where he began his early training in improvisation and dance technique. He was greatly influenced by working with Steve Paxton, as well as the dancing of Rudolf Nureyev, and was the first male dancer of the Trisha Brown Company from 1979 to 1986. He has gone on to build a unique career, receiving numerous accolades, including a John Simon Guggenheim Fellowship, awards from the Foundation for Contemporary Performance Arts, New York Foundation for the Arts, an American Choreography Award, and a New York Dance and Performance Bessie Award. Thank you for being with us, Stephen. Before Stephen comes out to speak, we're going to see a short video of one of his dance performances entitled Like Lazarus Did.
Thank you. These are my father's children, each one my father's child. These are my father's children, each one my father's child. These are my father's children, each one outshines on. These are my father's children, each one outshines on.
Start the story. How does it start? It starts like this, one word at a time. A story builds. So too in dance, one step at a time, set in motion, ideas become flesh. Ether and breath, untouchable, form just out of reach, written on air, a dance appears. Ready? And begin. Live man walking. I'm standing at the edge of the roof of the Whitney Museum, seven towering stories above 75th Street and Madison Avenue in Manhattan. Look up and it's all open sky. Look down and it's September, balmy, a blustery day, the wind whipping up against the front of my body and face, perfect for flight. My mood is pensive, unusually quiet. Breath deep and slow. The moment comes and I step out onto a metal scaffold, a portal into nothingness. The front of my body pulses at the free space, calling beyond the roof, an empty ache in my stomach and knees, new distance between my skull and scalp. I'm attached by harness and rope to scaffolding constructed as my support and fixed anchor on the building. I'm also connected to Jason, my fly expert slash guide. He's behind me and to my left and speaks in a cool, authoritative voice, a reassuring whisper in my left ear. Against my headstrong nature, I decide to give up control to his prompts, as what I'm about to do goes against every survival instinct and thread of logic I have. I clear my mind and do exactly as he says. "Ready," he says. "Let's go," I respond. I have a tight grasp at the metal frame on either side. "Step onto the ledge, left foot," he urges. "Done. Now right foot." "Done." I perch on the 4-inch aluminum ledge at the roof perimeter that holds my heels of the size 10.5 feet that I'm wearing. My heart syncopates and erupts through my shirt as my toes jut into the void, and I grip my heels and calves like never before. Can I grasp with my heels? I wonder, trying to grow instant Achilles talons to do so. The back surfaces of my body open to the space behind me, instinctively in retreat, trying to get closer to the roof, behind, to safe ground, my past. "Go back," comes a voice from deep inside. "Release your left hand," comes Jason's quiet command. I do, and paste it to my left outer thigh. "Now release your right hand," he continues. I obey, but a spring trap in my left hand is fired by my lizard mind, and I re-grasp the left side of the frame. "Let go with your left hand," he says more firmly, and I slowly comply, freestanding on my heels. The rush and surrender through my body is molten hot. "Lean forward slightly," he says. Thump, thump, thump. I know elementally that behind me is all that is safe and solid. Before me is ether. I force myself to stop straining back towards the ledge, and I tip my weight gently forward to lean out a degree or two. The schism between my thought and action disappears. Everything unites into the lean. A muffled gasp rises up from the crowd gathered down below to witness the moment that arrives. "Good to go?" he asks. "Go." I stretch out taut into the gaping emptiness before me, a slow motion dive pushing into the wall with my feet and away with the rest of my being. Everything in me, all my instincts, scream, "Wrong!" But I continue forward and out to shift my standing orientation 90 degrees. I stop, perpendicular to the building. I'm standing in the wrong plane, a perfect right angle. With the help of a rope and harness, we defeat gravity. I reorient myself and proceed to walk calmly down the length of the building to the street below. It's a short walk, perhaps 3 or 4 minutes, but it's one of the most significant of my life. Trisha Brown, renowned postmodern choreographer and my dance mentor, created Man Walking Down the Side of a Building in 1971. I performed it once for her as a dancer in her company in the 80s. And it was exciting then, 3 stories up a medieval tower in the south of France. But in 2010, my walk is different. Different beyond the additional height and the urban location, though they both matter. It's not merely a dance reconstructed, but a monument to honor the mind that helped to teach me how to challenge rules of perception, rules of physics, the tools of my trade as a dancer and choreographer. In one singular moment, I learned to definitively put my body on the line, shift perspectives, and venture out into the improbable, into the unknown. And the next day I feel my body head to toe like it's brand new again. Can't stop thinking about the moment of lean. The walk has given me a rush that lasts and transport me to a state of suspended reverie. I'm bigger, expanded. I'm an artist, a choreographer to be exact, and I make movement, dances, visceral things that exist in a moment of real time, then disappear, evaporate. Mine is the elusive art of shaping energy into form, of small adjustments, incremental growth, and daily disciplined practice. But stepping out onto the ledge of the Whitney roof and leaning out into Manhattan's slow motion, free fall, anti-gravity space is like taking my molecules to a cosmic, high-powered car wash. Renewed again. What more will it take for me to come clean? The boundaries of unknown possibility are thrilling terrain, and I've chased these boundaries on the dance floor ever since I started dancing, and in my life ever since I could remember. I'm riveted by the focus, the rush, the speed of the chase, the high stakes of awareness, and the pleasure that can result. And everybody's addicted to something, some more than others. I love these addictions like old friends. For better or worse, they belong to me. So, Ralph, are you going to join me? So, I'm Stephen. Hi, thank you for coming.
Why don't we have a seat? Thanks so much for that meeting. Will you show everyone your new book?
Yes, so this is my first book, and it's a memoir, and it's called Confessions of a Motion Addict. You can get it on Amazon, and it just came out a couple days ago, so I'm very, very excited and very proud. And thank you. It was important for me to prove that I could do something else besides move. But I started writing this in... a couple years ago, I was making a work called Ghost Town, and the premise was to build something that doesn't really exist, that's no longer there. And it sounded like a great idea when I was conceiving it, but it was a hell of a problem to make physical. So I was not sleeping very much. And so while I stopped sleeping, I began writing. And I decided just to begin writing memories from my childhood as a kind of exercise in writing down phantoms. And then I began to post them on Facebook, and then people began to send me backstories in response. And that rarely happens in dance, and I was very excited by that. And then eventually somebody said, well, when is this being published? And I thought, well, what are you talking about? And then I decided to do it. So there you go.
Well, I can tell this is going to be delightful because you've already answered several questions I was going to ask. That's okay. Great.
Sorry.
No, that's great. So I can ask other ones.
Okay.
So this is a pretty confessional memoir.
I seem to be a confessional kind of guy, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you began to talk about the differences between the feedback you got to your postings and then how that led to the book. I was wondering, did you think of or have you discovered some either differences or similarities with the creative process of dance, of creating dance and writing this memoir, or very different?
Well, I'm a very instinctive artist, so I fancy myself very well versed and studied in a certain level of intelligence, but really it's a mysterious process to me, and it comes in washes of inspiration, whether it's in movement or writing. So, and often the beginning of something is the gift. And I'm an Aries, which is the child of the zodiac, and in some circles, the Aries has the most to learn, but we're very good beginners. And so I'm great at beginning everything. And then I usually get a bunch of people to help me finish everything. So the writing for me was very similar. It came in great rushes of formed thought. And then especially the younger years were quite easy for me because I had very strong visual pictures in my mind, and I just had to paint them with words. But when I got to be like an 18, 19-year-old adult who was thinking and making decisions, that writing was much more difficult to to be as interested in on that emotional level. So so that was interesting to understand. And when you're creating in the studio, the things that inspire you in the studio for dance, the things that inspire you come very naturally, and then the problem of craft and transition and elaboration of a theme are the work. So I think they're quite similar.
Well, one of the things that struck me as I read it, and Stephen was kind enough to let me have a chance to read it a few weeks ago, was that it is not linear in terms of the chronology. You jump around a bit. Is that something that was planned? It must have been at a certain level. What were you getting at with that?
Well, I have a very my mind is fractured, but I know I wanted to. You know, I'm a choreographer and a dancer, and so. And motion is the centerpiece of my life. But I wanted to write a book that was about my life, not just about. I didn't really want to write a book about motion, but there's a lot of motion in it. And so I wanted to give you the sense of restless ping-ponging around the way my experience comes back to mind. And the way my memories kind of collide, and so, yeah. And I just thought to write a linear memoir would be the first thing I should do, so I decided not to do that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the title is significant. You entitle it Confessions of a Motion Addict. And if I might, you talk a lot about addiction. Mm. And I'm wondering if you think about that and how it's involved with not only your body, but with dance and creativity?
Hmm. Well, that's a very good question. I am quite open about substance and alcohol and sex and all the things that that kind of drove my early life. And you know, there were many times in the beginning of my career where I was a full-throttle, wild person, but I have a very high sense of responsibility, and part of the reason I started a dance company was because I was raised to be responsible to people, and that's my nature. And so if I'm expected somewhere, I will show up, and I will show up prepared. So I knew that starting a social structure like a dance company would keep me in check to a certain degree. So that's part of why I did. I mean, leave me alone and I'm in trouble. But put me in a group and I'm good. So so I knew that would be a smart thing to do. But, you know, I often think about, you know, I ask myself, I made some great work very hungover. And I've been sober for over 5 years now. And so I've made some powerful work sober as well. So, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, when I was younger, it was faster and it was meaner. And I would allow you to watch, but I wouldn't talk directly to you as an artist. And now I'm much more interested in speaking with you. So maybe there's a difference there. But, you know, I was moving at a much higher velocity when I was bent. I'll say.
Well, you know, I suppose this is what we literature professors think about. I mean, only now was I thinking about confessions, and then the fact that, in a sense, all confessions, certainly in the wake of Augustine, have a point of conversion. Mm. And you talk about the moment where you decide to become sober.
Yeah.
Want to talk about that?
Well, sure. So I was, I stopped taking illegal substances around 40. So I thought that was the right thing to do. But drinking, I just thought was normal. And I didn't really realize, I started taking various kinds of drugs in high school. So to me, it was research. I never thought of it as illegal or destructive, or, you know, I grew up in the 70s, so there wasn't a lot of bad press back then about drugs. And so I just kind of thought of it as research. When I hit 40, I realized it was time to stop. My body said, hello, my knees, you've got to stop. So And then, so from 40 to 50, I was drinking. And so I thought that was safe, except that I, you know, was a normal night was a couple of bottles of wine. And so the first one was lubrication, and the second one was enjoyable. And that began to have a real toll on my body. And so there's two, I noticed that I've always looked kind of healthy, and because I'm dancing, I stay in good shape, and I have good genes, so I look, you know, younger than I am. But I began to look a little puffy and green around the edges, I noticed. And then one night I went to the Guggenheim Awards. I had received a Guggenheim in the 80s, and I was invited. You get invited back every year to welcome the new recipients. And so I went, and it was a very, in the dance world, it's a very big deal, and lots of friends were there. And I drank myself into a stupor, and I was having a great time. And then I got on a train to go home, because I live about an hour north of the city. And I had, at that time, I had bought a vintage diesel Mercedes. And it was very, very, it's a workhorse of the luxury car. So it's kind of like a tank, but it could move. And so when I got off the train, I stopped in a bar and I had another God knows how much to drink. And then I got into my Mercedes and I was roaring home through the back. I was very country where I live, and I was probably doing around 90. Around some very hairy curves, and you know, so speed. Stephen loves speed. I barely noticed how fast I was going, and I went into a full tailspin, and ended up facing this rocky cliff. And my first thought was, "Oh, thank God the car is fine," because I love my car. And then I got home, and I realized that I didn't really have much consideration for the fact that I was fine. And I thought, well, I made a note to look into that. And then a few weeks later, my husband, Jean-Marc, was having his birthday. And we weren't married yet. So it was his birthday. And I, being Italian, wanted to be married ever since I was a child. So I've been egging him on and egging him on. And he's much more relaxed and shyer than I am. So, you know, it was an ongoing issue. We've been together for 17 years, but it was an ongoing issue. And he finally agreed that that it was time to get married. And so it was his birthday, and I got very sauced up at a party before, and I went to meet him at his birthday. And we're sitting around a table of friends and relatives, and I mentioned that, oh my God, Jean-Marc finally has decided that it's time to get married. And Jean-Marc asked me to keep it under my hat, which sent me into like a blackout, basically. And so then two or three times in my life, this horrendously evil ogre has made an appearance. And usually it's in the privacy of my own home. But that night, it was in full view in a restaurant of friends. And I don't really remember what happened, but I was very, I was not nice to everybody sitting around that table. And the next morning, I got up and a friend of mine, Maria Casso, who's a life coach, called me, and she also is on the board of the Betty Ford Clinic, and she said, well, you know, Stephen, you could do it two ways. I could get you into Betty Ford today, or I could do it with you one-on-one. And so she counted the first 90 days with me one-on-one, and I haven't had a drink since. So it was quite, I'm not going to say it was easy. Those first couple of years, though, were not difficult. The hard work begins a few years down the line.
Well, I promise we won't talk about addiction the whole time, but I have to, you know, reflect on the fairly recent death of Philip Seymour Hoffman. And,
yeah.
And, you know, do you think of the arts community and the number of people who seem to not be able to be creative without that degree of being on the edge?
I don't think it's about being creative without being on the edge. I think it's about coping with the mechanisms that get you to that edge. You know, I know for me, when I was at full throttle, I loved getting to the point of the cliff where I was scared that I couldn't get back. And then I knew I had done proper research. But really, it's about, for a lot of people, it's about pain and insecurity. And I mean, for Philip, I think he was petrified of acting. I mean, he said that he's petrified of acting. And what you have to do, Barbara Streisand, she's phobic about singing in public. I mean, what you have to do to get yourself to the place where you're going to show your talent, I think is often a daunting thing for people. So I always tell this story where when I don't dance that much anymore. I mostly choreograph, but it got to the point where, and I'm a relatively sane person, but you know, it got to the point where you begin before a show during the preparation, the doubt and the self-loathing and the, is my body perfect? Will I remember the steps? Am I sharp enough? Will it be as good as last night? All that stuff piles up. And then you do the show and then you think, oh, I'm great. So afterwards, everything is fine. But before, it's crazy. And I think that's a lot of what it's about in general.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the making of the dancer. And actually, I was fortunate enough to meet Stephen. Probably it's a good thing that I wasn't the 70s because I might be in the book. But but it was a few years ago since, as you heard, Stephen's a graduate of Hampshire College, one of our illustrious alumni, so I got to meet him in that. What role did your time at Hampshire play in becoming a dancer?
Well, I'm very indebted to Hampshire College. First of all, I was given a full scholarship. So, I come from relatively modest background. My father was a truck driver and my mother was a homemaker. And Hampshire at the time in the 70s didn't have an endowment. And it was an experimenting laboratory for the Ivy League schools in the Amherst Valley. In the Connecticut River Valley, Amherst College and UMass and Smith College in Mount Holyoke. And so I was given a full scholarship, and so I went against my parents' better judgment because they didn't understand what the education was like, and they couldn't control it because they weren't paying for it. So I went, and of course, I was the first son to go to college, and so being a good Italian second son, I was going to be a doctor. And I thought that was what I should do, and I was excited about doing it. And so I began my medical studies, and then I... Hampshire does a very... Back in those days, it was doing a very interesting thing. There was a two-week initiation period where you got to go to parties and go to lectures, and classes didn't begin for 2 weeks. Basically, you got all your partying done in those 2 weeks, and then by the time it was over, you were really ready to buckle down to study. Well, in those 2 weeks, I met a girl, and I was quite smitten with her, and so and she was a dancer, and we were dancing at lots of parties, and she said, "Oh, you know, you're really pretty coordinated. You should take a dance class." And I've always been like a brain box, always reading, not very athletic, not competitive, at least in sports. And so I decided to take a dance class to relax. And in that class, there was a teacher. It was an improvisation class, and in that class, I was led to the moment of discovering my body, which I remember like it was yesterday. And I basically realized I had a body that was, something was below what I saw in the mirror, and it hit me in a very profound way, and so that has continued my interest in studying what the body can tell you.
So you, while you're here with your troupe, you've also been working with some of our dance students. Yeah. How's that going?
Very well. We've had one of our amazing dancers has started the process. Julian has been teaching the past couple of days, and I'll go in tomorrow. But they, it's always beautiful to come to a school and teach because that's where it started for me. So I'm very aware of that. It's only 1 or 2 hours that you get with these kids, but you can change someone in a second. And almost everybody who's involved in the dance arts has the moment where they saw someone and they said, oh, I have to do that. So you never know when it's going to happen. And sometimes people come back to me and 10 years down the line. And, you know, dance, you don't make a lot of money as a choreographer or a dancer, but your life is profound and it's exciting. And people will come to me and say, oh my God, I saw that show of X, Y, and Z, and I've never been the same. And so you have no idea that this is happening. So whenever I'm in a class, I'm always aware of that. So I find that this age especially, in the college age, is very special.
So we want people to buy the book, so we don't want to give away too many secrets. Okay. But and you did mention Tricia and how you began to dance for her. My question is, how do you go, we've talked about discovering the dancer, what about the choreographer? Do you think you were a dancer first and then a choreographer, or were you always somehow primed to do choreography? Are you a choreographer who dances, or is that an impossible?
I perceive myself as a creator who was moving. And because in Hampshire, I was mostly doing improvisation. I wasn't training in ballet or anything else. I was I took a couple of modern survey classes. I wasn't very interested in ballet, but I was very interested in a form of improvisation called contact improvisation, which was kind of an art sport, and it's a duet form. And it was developed by a guy named Steve Paxton. So I was 18, so I didn't think I would ever be a good dancer. But I was very bossy, and I had a lot of ideas. And immediately in that first improvisation class, I began composing structures for moving groups of people. And so I thought, well, you know, I love this, and I'm gonna be a creator. And then, after the fourth year, I was kind of getting okay. I was no longer embarrassing as a dancer. And then I met Tricia Brown, and my first year after I graduated, I moved to New York and met Tricia Brown, and I auditioned for her, and I have to say that I auditioned about 10 years above my level of skill. So something possessed me, and then she was stuck with me. So, and she made me a good dancer, really. I mean, Tricia is one of the great geniuses of our day, and to work alongside of her, not only did she force me to become a good dancer, but I got to apprentice with one of the great creative minds, so that was right up my alley creatively.
So I also have to ask about music. And again, this is probably, you know, an impossible or dumb question to ask, but when you're thinking of creating a dance, do you, in a sense, have the dance in your mind and then find the music, or is the music first and then you find the dance?
Well, the one thing I could tell you, I come from a tradition of experimentation. So there's no one way that I do anything. So the bad thing is I had to figure out everything myself. The good thing is I had to figure out everything myself. So and when you're creating something original, that helps. So I didn't have to let go of my technical skill to become more creative. There's a trade-off. But because I started in the experimental world, there was never music first. The movement always came first, and then I would try to find music that either went with it or I would have it written for me. And I did that for many years. So I was either co-creating with my composer, or they were scoring me like a film. So I would make the dance first, and they would take the video and score it like a film. But at a certain point, when I began to get interested in more virtuosity, and I began to get bored with my own rhythmic patterns, I began to choose great musical monoliths. And so the first one I chose was the Rite of Spring, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. I thought, well, you know, if you don't know anything, if you can't read music, you might as well start with a great work. And so that music and that libretto led me through. So I choreographed that in a very traditional way. So, in an odd way, the experimental choreographer became the most traditional kind of choreographer, where, you know, I was letting the music lead me. But now I go back and forth as I choose. And the work that I'm performing, by the way, please come on Friday to to the show here. It's a very special show to me. And we have Janine Antoni, who's the visual artist, who will be inside of the sculpture. It's a living sculpture, and it'll be on stage. So please come to that. But, in that case, the composer Ryan Lott, who I made four or five works with, I know very well. So he brought me some music, and he would play something, and maybe we'll talk more about in depth about this, but
that's what I wanted to talk about, so go right ahead.
Okay, so Ryan, you know, we've made four or five works together, and you're mostly in Europe, never on my company, but I was kind of waiting until I thought he was ready, because he's young, he's much younger than me, and I love what he does, but I wasn't sure how I could use his skill. And he has a great sense, he's classically trained, but he's kind of interested in rock and experimental electronic music. So he's got a very wide range. And the first project we did was based on Romeo and Juliet, so the Prokofiev score was kind of a thing that he referred to, but he was also much wilder than that as well. Anyway, we got well-versed with each other, and he sent me this songbook that he discovered, and it was a series of slave songs from the 1700s that had never been published before. And these songs were unique in that they had only been passed mouth to mouth, you know, sung oral tradition. And then they were finally published. Some of them were just shards of songs. And the language was incomprehensible in some of them. I mean, there was kind of English, not this English that I'm speaking, not black English, it was just an English that I didn't understand. And so we navigated our way through these songs, and there were maybe 30 or 40 songs, and we chose three or four of them, and then he kind of wrote off of the lyrics that we could understand and that we researched a little bit. And so it was very much back and forth. And so the first, the one that you saw was, "These are my father's children." Well, that was the one line that remained from that song that we could understand. So that became the kind of a mantra for that section of the music. And we did a bunch of songs that were quite, they were sad. Some of them were really sad, and some of them were powerful. But I, you know, he would throw something at me, and I would throw something back. And then at some point, it occurred to me that we needed to start the work with an alleluia, just not because it was in the songbook, but I just thought, I don't know, we need to have an alleluia. It just popped into my head, and he was kind enough to agree. And so I sent him one that I thought would be an interesting one. He was like, "I hate that." And then he sent me back another one, and it's the alleluia that you'll see in the show, and it's quite beautiful and quite original. And in the score that you'll be hearing on Friday, it's Ryan's voice with the Young People's Chorus of New York, which is a wonderful choir that I met in New York that I've worked with on a number of occasions.
But I know this from some of your shows, that you sometimes have choral music, and often you like to go around and work with a young person's chorus.
I love doing that. We're not doing it here because the chorus that was here wasn't available. But and they have, you know, mostly the choruses have, especially the kids, have become so popular that they've booked years in advance. But so we have the score with the Young People's Chorus if we can't get a live chorus. But I love working with a local chorus because it connects you to the community in a much different way. And I've been doing this for 30 years. So when you come into town, you know, usually you have to find the best restaurant, you have to find the museum, and then you do your show and you're gone. But when you have a chorus, you know, you have to work with them. And then the kids get attached to them, and you rehearse with them, and then their parents get involved, and, you know, it becomes a whole other... And for many of them, it's the first time they're involved with dance, so it's very exciting.
Well, you know, you talked about the touring, and, you know, you're not just a choreographer. Your dance troupe has been continuously involved for over 25 years.
30 now. This is our 30th anniversary.
It's been 5 years since 25. Okay. That is a massive amount of business work that you have to do. I mean, what's it like to actually, you know, be the entrepreneur?
Well, you know, dancers eat food. And we actually spend money, and some of them smoke cigarettes, and you know, we are real people, so we have real needs, and they tend to make it all look so easy. And when you're seeing a show, you should only think about what the inspiring message is, or whatever is being presented on stage. You should only be really experiencing that. But the backstory is that it's full of pain and struggle and insecurity and lack of funding in this country, particularly. Now, Europe has become a copycat of America, so the funding is really going downhill there. So my job used to be, I used to take a year and a half to make a dance, 20 or 30 minute dance, and I would take my time and really research it as thoroughly as possible and move. Even though I move fast, the process was very methodical and slow. And now I'm down, I get maybe 12 weeks, and that's for a full evening. So I would say 75% of my time is begging people for money and trying to make this work. Now, you have an amazing facility here, so I hope you're not taking it for granted. But the country used to be filled with amazing facilities, and many of the producers and presenters that were a haven for dance can no longer get the funding from the state or the government that they need. They have to rely on ticket sales, so they have to bring in Broadway shows. Now, nothing against Broadway shows, but they're replacing the other shows. So maybe there would be one Broadway show in a season, now there has to be three. And so maybe, I don't know how many modern dance companies you have on your series, but it used to be a theater like this would have a series of 10 dance companies. And now I think for financial reasons, many of the producers that I know, have known over the years, have to have one dance company, one theater company, one music company, and, you know, a couple of Broadway plays. So my opportunities, and not just me, but the opportunities for touring have been eroded. So, you know, it's kind of a losing game. Some people think we're looking at a dying art. I like to be much more positive about that and say that if it's good enough, it will survive. But I do a lot of fundraising.
So, well, I mean, I have to ask then, since you talk about the future, what are the newest waves you see coming along, things that really excite you?
Well, I want to say that everyone is saying that the model of the dance company is disappearing and that it no longer functions. And maybe that's true. I've gone from 30 weeks of year to 10 weeks of year of touring. So what I'm looking forward to, instead of thinking, oh, poor me, I'm thinking about what do I want the next model for my career to look like. And the most important thing to me, and the thing that I love about dancing, and the reason that I could do it for 30 years, despite the physical pain, the financial difficulty, the emotional stress, am I good enough? Is this piece going to be great enough? What, you know, all that stuff, is that I get to go into the studio with a bunch of 20 to 30-year-old Olympian artists, and we're half, you know, half in our pajamas, we're barefoot, and we're researching intuitive motion, and that there's nothing like that. And when a piece is finished, I'm sitting this close to it, watching the fine details of it being rehearsed, and that is like the most nurturing and amazing gift of my life. So no matter what, that needs to be preserved. So my new thing is to develop a creative research center outside of New York City, and it's I've chosen Pawling, New York, and it's a 35-acre facility where me and five other companies like me over the course of the year can have guaranteed 2 months of that precious creative time. And whether it tours or not, that will always be there. So instead of relying on the financial gain from 30 weeks of touring, the money will come from private donors for that creative research. And then the touring will, if it happens, will be the fun thing instead of the thing that we have to do to make a living. So that's what I'm excited about.
That's cool. So why don't we open it up to questions? I think that means that the lights come up because otherwise I couldn't possibly point to someone. And I know that there are microphones here. Let's see. Yes, there are two microphones there. So we're very interested to hear if audience members have questions. And if so, please come on up to one of the mics. You know,
and no question is stupid. So please, I like dumb questions.
I think we're going to have a question.
I like it.
I don't know if the mic's turned on or not.
It is.
Okay. What's interesting to me about dance is that I don't know the moves. I don't know how to understand what it is that I'm seeing. I know that ballet has certain arabesques, for example. In the piece that we saw tonight, the movements were abstract to me. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know if you can explain in terms that I can understand, so I could see and understand what it is that's going on there rather than just movement.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're not alone, and I hear this from men a lot, especially because We need, as a species, the male race needs to rationally understand everything that we see and make some kind of sense of it. And I'm with you there. I relate to that. And a lot of times when I'm not dancing, I'm sneaking around at intermission and I'm listening to the guys who are like, "Did you get that?" And you know, everybody has to get it. So I would say, and I'm not going to avoid your question, I'm going to answer your question, but I would say, forget about understanding it. Because what I'm talking to is not your rational brain. I'm talking to your intuitive mind. And that mind does not need a rational explanation. And in fact, you might go to sleep tonight, and when you experience the movement live, it might revisit you when you're falling asleep, or maybe the next day, or you know, maybe you'll never think of it again. But I'm looking to subvert your rational inquiry as a choreographer by putting, well, you saw that it started with one solo and then it built to a choral cacophony of similar movements that you couldn't possibly absorb all at once. And I do that very intentionally because I want you to see the space around the dancers and the space between them as much as I want you to see the movement. But I, to someone who wants to know what it means, I would say, what did you see? And just describe what you saw. So I'll show you one of his thematic movements is this. So what do you see when I do that?
Well, I could see somebody bathing and throwing water on themselves.
Great. So these are my father's children. I'm done with this troubled world. So maybe they're washing the world off. Maybe with the image that I was looking for with him, because I started that with Josh Green, who I love very dearly, as I do all my dancers. But I was looking to pull imagery up from the ground, from the earth, because the song is kind of a burial song. The image that I get from the song is kind of, I see Confederate soldiers dead on the field when I hear that song. I'm done with this troubled world. These are my father's children. They're done with this troubled world. It's the moment of departure for them from this body. So I was looking at pulling up in the creative process things from the ground, things from our unconscious, things from movements from our irrational world. So and to wash that away. So that you saw what you saw. There were a few arabesques in there, by the way.
Well, you would have to show it again, so I'm pointing them out to me.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
But the last thing I wanted to, the 1, 3, 5 were prime numbers to me, and that's the rational side of me.
Yeah.
But the other thing was that since I couldn't figure it out, and I was wasting time distracting myself and trying to figure it out, I just kind of sat there and said, what am I feeling?
Yeah.
What am I seeing? And I saw the musculature and the movements. Some were fast, some were graceful, some were slow. So thank you very much.
Yes, you're so welcome. Yeah.
So shall we go to this mic for just a minute?
I just want to add that this piece, like Lazarus did, is a journey from death to birth. So it's Lazarus comes back. If you know the story of Lazarus, that in that myth or story, however you want to perceive it, Lazarus comes back from the grave. And so I was looking at rebirth and rebirth imagery. So that's, you know, that's a little hint, but go ahead.
I'm not going to ask about that.
Okay. That's
I'm
okay.
Going to ask, I wonder about the space you were talking about in upstate New York briefly.
Yeah.
Will people be able to come there and see people at work? Will it be a place where...
Yes, we love to have guests watch us. You know, to come in and watch the creative process tells you so much about what's... You know, you sit in the theater and you pay your ticket and it's great because you get a thrill. But when you get into the creative process and when you watch something being built and then you see it later, there's nothing like it because you own it, because you understand it visually. You saw the things that get thrown away and how it gets shaped. And I find that people really respond to that, and so we want guests.
Okay, and then I was really taken by the story you told at the beginning and being at the edge and walking down the building. And then as you spoke in answer to some of the questions, you talked about your drugs, your alcohol, sex, and all that stuff. And I was wondering, did you ever do that walk down the building higher than high?
Never.
And
never.
Can you imagine
never,
that?
No.
Yeah.
But I can't. I have to tell you, I have experimented with almost every substance that's known to man, and women, and I have never been higher than that moment of leaning out. It expanded my consciousness in a way that I can't even tell you. And I wrote that thing a million different times, and I still can't make it. That moment of letting go of your orientation and leaning out, I became 20 feet tall. I tried to get my molecules to lock onto the space across the building across the street from me. And I can't explain it any other way, but I was huge for about a week. And so I begged Trisha to let me do it many times. And actually, Trisha is no longer, she's had a stroke, and so she's no longer creating, but she has, her company has allowed me to license the work, so I'll be doing it again, and I'm really excited.
Wow.
Thank you.
Yeah. Chancellor.
What really inspires you to dance? Is it, do you dance for yourself to express your own feelings? Do you dance to communicate with others? Do you do it as a way to push yourself to do things that you did not think you could do?
Well, I think those are all really very good reasons. I think for me personally, it's to feel my body, that when I'm making movement, I can feel myself in a way that I didn't before. There's a section in the book that talks about walking into the studio. And, you know, you walk into the studio and you're a normal person who is thinking about what they ate and, it's cold in the room and it's hot, or it's hot in the room, or my back is killing me and I'm too old or too ugly, or I just had a great relationship, or, you know, whatever you're thinking about. You're a human being. What am I going to have for lunch? I don't know. And then you begin to focus in and meditate on your body and your training. And then you slip into a state, what happens to me is that I slip into an altered state of being, and where everything comes together and energy begins to flow through my body and I am connected. So I would say, and then I am free. And that's a very magic state to be in. And so people who exercise a lot, you know that endorphin rush. Well, it's a very similar experience. And I would say that my primary reason for continuing to dance is to connect to myself, to connect to the viewer, to connect to the world, to connect to space.
Please.
Sure. I was impressed with what appeared to me to be the athleticism of the dancers. And you mentioned that when you were young, you weren't an athlete. Hmm. But if you were doing this kind of dancing, you had to be pretty athletic. So could you talk about the role of athleticism in dance? And I work with Olympic caliber people that are involved in movement too, and it looks like it's very much the same.
Well, I have to say, I was on the crew team in high school. I loved to do things in a group, but I didn't like one-on-one. I was fearful. I didn't like one-on-one. I was forced to be on the baseball team when I was little, and I had a very traumatic experience, and I got hit with the ball, and I dropped it all the time, and I was like kind of a spaz. And my brother was the most valuable player of every sport there was. And I'm also gay, so it was like, oh my God, do I want to be around these guys competing with them? I'm not really. And in those days, it mattered much more than it does now. And so I was physically very timid, and I found my power through motion. And then I began to build my body. I began to weight train. I began to swim continually. And so at 18, I had a reawakening. So I became athletic. And so one of the hallmarks of my dance is like a highly athletic thing. You know, I mean, I love the idea of the muscular or toned man or woman doing incredibly fluid things. To me, that's so exciting. And a lot of the dance that I saw, that I've seen before me, was much more position-oriented. The gentleman mentioned arabesque. Well, my arabesques spin and flash by, so you can catch them, but they never hold. We're never still. I mean, I'm in continuous motion. So, my dancers are amazing athletes, and I push them to the nth degree.
Does it feel like it's competitive, dancing?
Well, funding is competitive. I will say
I think the
thing that you saw has had a choral feel to it. I really am very much about a group of people making an moving architectural statement in space, and so that's about harmony, not competition.
Thank you.
See that.
So one theme that seemed to run through your remarks was the issue of negotiating things that have disappeared, things that are in the past. You know, your initial anecdote was actually about a reconstruction of the dance that you'd done earlier, and you mentioned the Ghost Town piece, which is also about things that are gone. And then this really interesting account of having to work with these songs that are vestigial and partial, you know, and that are fragments of something bigger, but those things are lost. And in some ways, all of dance is negotiating that problem, I think, and that it's kind of disappearing as it happens. But I'm just curious about what your own thoughts are about how dance helps you to think through the problem of disappearance and the, you know, and issues around reconstruction, bringing things back.
Well, that's a beautiful question, by the way. Are you a dancer?
Yes.
In my skin are stories, and I don't know they're there until I begin to give them form. And I'm a very energetic person, and the discipline for me is to weld that energy into form that resonates the emotional or physical or intellectual story that I'm interested in at that moment. One of the techniques I use is called ether sketching. Sketching with ether, being on a pad with a pencil, you're doodling your thoughts. Well, and then you say, oh my God, I drew an elephant, or oh my God, I drew a something Freudian, or whatever it is you drew. And then you begin to have a little self-awareness about what your subconscious mind might be thinking. Well, the same thing, you can doodle with your body. And what you have to do is unfocus your mind and then slip into the state that we were talking about earlier. And then information begins to come that may or may not be profound. Some of it is boring. Some of it is mundane, some of it is shocking. And I know in my life that my body knows everything before my mind does. That's just the way I am. I've been given a gift of like feeling things through my skin. And that's all I think it is. So I would say that movement helps me to mark the memoir of my life.
Thank you.
That was a gorgeous question, thank you.
Please.
So you gave kind of a bleak picture of the future of dance and your own sort of talking about the role of touring and whatever. And I happen to be the parent of a 14-year-old who wants to be a modern dancer. And I'm wondering what sort of advice you would give to an aspiring dancer or her parent in terms of thinking about that. I was also the child of a composer, so I know all about funding for the arts and whatever. But
well, first I would say my first advice would be to bring her to the show. And then I'll tell you the rest of the voice when I see you there. No.
she's here.
Oh, good. So I would say don't expect... Where are you? Don't expect to make a lot of money. I'm serious. I'm as famous as they can be, and I'm paycheck to paycheck. Expect to have a life that you would not trade anything for. If you truly find your niche in dancing... You have to do it because you want to do it like nothing else, because it's going to hurt, it's going to keep you away from some things you might want to do at night that you can't, you know, that you don't have time to do. It's going to interfere in your relationships. It's going to hurt again. Your body is the limitation, but some of the most creative moments in my life have come from limitation. So I would not trade this life for anything. It does help to marry well. But I would really say try to find the aspect of dance that makes you the happiest and pursue it until you absolutely can't anymore. And then if you can't, then you can't. And then move on to something else. I am very stubborn. So I can't let go of it. I mean, everyone's been telling me for 5 years, 10 years, dance companies are dead. Well, I'm not letting go. You have to carry me out of here feet first.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was... Please.
Hi, Stephen.
Hey.
How are you?
You look great.
Yeah, I haven't seen you in a while.
Yeah.
I actually wanted to just be one of that one person for this presentation to say, to tell the story of saying, I saw you in 1989 in a trio at Serious Fun at Lincoln Center.
Wow.
With Frey and I think Ori?
Jeremy.
Yeah. That completely changed my understanding of what a human body could do.
Oh my God.
And really, and it, kind of in answer to the first gentleman of like, I think for me also in dance, what it means is secondary to what it does or what it performs for us, and the way that you create bodies and the virtuosity of the body and the beauty of the body just really has several times really changed my vision of what's possible. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And,
that's so sweet.
Yeah, I'm sorry I'm not going to be able to make it on Friday.
Oh. But come to rehearsal.
I'd love to.
Yeah.
I'd love to.
You're
so
welcome,
thank you very, very much. It's nice to see you again.
Did everyone hear? So, what is the relationship between music and silence in your work?
Well, John Cage teaches us that silence is music. So I would say that it's part of the music. Silence is part of the music. Because I'm not a classically trained choreographer, I don't read music. I am the total punk, do-it-yourself, self-trained. But I understand music like nobody. So when I'm listening to music, I'm listening to the space between things all the time, between sounds. And if you look closely at my choreography, it looks like it's very beat-oriented, especially some of the earlier work is very driving and looks like it's on the beat. But I am syncopating around the beat constantly with my body. It's kind of a polyrhythmic or a multiple rhythmic attack in the body. And so I look for the space between sounds often to inhabit that so that I'm not a total slave to the beat. It's a different kind of prison, but it's a spatial prison. Right now I'm reconstructing a work called Strange Attractors Part 1, and the great English composer Michael Nyman he wrote the music for the piano and Gattaca, many other things. So I had the pleasure of commissioning him back in the 90s, and he sent me a series, a suite of songs that were, you know, his music is, he's kind of minimalist, repetitive music, but very lush and very romantic and very just so sweeping and beautiful. And so I was used to some much grittier music, and it's so pretty. And the work ended up becoming looking much more romantic than I'd ever intended or had made before. And so one of the things that I did was, when he would put a gap between, he would do one song and then another, and instead of blending them, I separated them with silence. But I didn't finish the dance on the song. I finished the dance into the silence, so that you could see the high romanticism of the relationship between the dance and the music, and then you could see the romanticism stripped away and see what the movement sounds like in the silence, because there is a sound to the movement in silence. And so that became a source of great pleasure to me and a way to subvert the purely romantic nature of Michael's music and to win a little, like have a little upper hand once in a while with Michael. And so Michael and I, he saw the company perform, we agreed to collaborate, and then he was in England, and it was the very beginning of internet, so we were sending videos back and forth and emailing back and forth. And when he came to the opening in London, afterwards he joked. He says, "Oh, I love the way you ignored me completely." So, but I didn't ignore him completely, and I love his music, and I have great respect for his music, and I love that piece, and I'm bringing it back in New York for my 30th anniversary on April. It opens April 8th. If you're on the East Coast, please come.
And so you say you're not competitive.
It's a man thing.
John.
I wanted to come back to something you said about the memoir, and you were talking about your early life, and it was actually, you had these kind of emotional pictures that were really easy to paint with words, yeah, in a certain sense. And then there was that moment around 19, 18 when you said started thinking, and I somehow couldn't write anymore. And the interesting thing is that's the same moment where, in a way, you're discovering dance. I don't know if there's any connection there, or thinking about what it would mean to, you know, express in language, because a lot of the choreographers I know, language is difficult, and for me, yeah, as a word person, the visual is so difficult.
Well, if you might notice, I'm pretty wordy.
Yes.
But I think those images from those early... can I read one? Just so there's like,
please,
2 seconds. Just because they're kind of corny, but I love them. So I remember the moment of knowing that I am here and the world is out there. I'm swinging on my backyard swing set, hurling high up in the air, little pelvis penduluming up and down through space, a tiny body measured against the charcoal gray corduroy texture of the shingled wall that is my house. This is me, and all that is everything else. I am a single separate person in space, my body apart and in motion, flying, pumping, soaring higher to dizzy heights of... So those kind of images, I have very, very vivid early... They're emotional. This one happened to be physical. Many of them through the book are physical images, that physical experiences that froze an image in my mind. One of them was the women, in the 50s, all the women wearing these most incredible dresses and kind of floating around the room. And, I'm Italian, so there's always food and always parties, and these women kind of hovering in these great pastel colored dresses. I mean, those things were just locked in my mind, so I didn't have to think about them. All I had to do is remember them. I think when you get older, your primary experience of the world becomes more rational, and that's what happened to me, I think. But I work hard to get back there. So,
Gina.
Good question.
Can you repeat it?
Yes. So is it more to that?
Well, I was thinking
about
your image of
Janine. Yeah. So, what's my connection to my relationship to visual artists?
And what's your process? Kind of like Ralph's question.
Yeah. Right. So I, because I deal in ether, I have a great jealousy of the visual artists who express something, and then it becomes an object that they then can touch and revisit every day. So, and I didn't have that envy until when I was 21, I met Trisha Brown, and so I didn't know much about dance at all. I was only dancing for 4 years, and within a few weeks of that, she said, "Stephen, come on, we're going to Bob's house for dinner." And I was like, "Well, Bob who?" And she said, "Well, Bob Rauschenberg." And I was like, "Well, who's Bob Rauschenberg?" And of course it was the 70s, so I had to go to the library to find out who Bob Rauschenberg was. I couldn't Google him. And so there, within a month of meeting the great choreographer who was going to change my life, I was meeting Bob Rauschenberg, and who was a brilliantly unhinged artist. Who had a great love of dance, and he had, I believe, Bob was like a child, and he had the ability to put on in two dimensions rhythm. Somehow he loved dance, and he had a way of he invented collage pretty much, where images appear together and in juxtaposition to each other. And many people try to copy that. Very difficult. Technique, and it's easy to use it for many different reasons. But Bob created space and depth and rhythm, and I have one of his pieces still, and I look at it every day, and it's different every day. It's always floating and it's always changing, and so I got a great love. Initially, these were my tradition is these non-traditional people. And so they were collaborating, and I just, you know, it just became very natural to me that, oh, if you're going to dance, you have to have music, and you have to have fashion, and you have to have visual art. And I'm, you know, in many ways, I'm very envious of the superficial, the world of the surface is something that I'm not afraid of, and I love. So, and I'm also very social, so I want to have these people around me, and I want them pushing me off a cliff. Janine, who, when you come on Friday, Janine, I invited Janine into my world because Janine uses her body. She's a sculptor, but she's many other things, and she uses her body in the process of whatever she's doing, and she has a performative element to what she does. And so when I met Janine, I invited her in because after 30 years of trying to establish a language, it was established. And then I thought, well, now what do I do? But now I've got a language. Is that it? I'm just going to be like using this language over and over again to do this, you know, to do what I'm doing. So I invited Janine in with the intention of having her screw me up a little bit. And boy, has she. In this piece, she's made, she's very gentle in this piece. She looked at my work and she said, well, it doesn't stop. So I'm going to be a still counterpoint. In the premiere, she was hanging above the audience, and we can't do that here, but so she'll be hanging over the dance. But she's in a deep, still meditation on mortality and physicality. So that is her contribution to the work. And there's a milagro of body parts that's suspended above her, and she's suspended underneath that, and that's all above the dance. So, but now we're doing other things. And she and I are doing other things, and I found a soulmate in creativity. And so she likes to talk as much as I do, and she's really slow, and I'm really fast, and it works very well. So we're creating various other sculptural elements, and we did a video together called Honey Baby, based on the last solo in Like Lazarus Did that you'll see. So, and this is the way Janine has screwed me up. I had this idea, we're going to start with death and it's going to end with birth. And so the last piece of the evening on Friday is a solo. And the solo was taken, my cousin at the time was pregnant. And so she was sending me the sonograms of her child in utero. So I was looking at them and I'm thinking, well, if I'm going to make a dance about birth, I need to use... And the child's name is Trevor, so we call that last solo Trevor. So I took a lot of the shapes that Trevor was making in utero, and I built them into a dance that ends the piece. And it's all on the floor. So Janine sees that, and she's like, well, we've got to cover that thing in honey. And I'm like, well, I love the idea, but on a proscenium stage, you know, honey gets everywhere. It'll be there for years, and the theater just wouldn't have it. So... But I loved the way she tried to interject something that nobody would ever think of into honey, amniotic fluid, sustenance, and things that a guy like me would never think about. And so it didn't happen, but we thought, well, it'll happen in a gallery. And then she did what no other visual artist did. She invited me into her world, and she said, well, why don't we make a piece of visual art together based on Trevor? And so we made a video in utero, in honey, of the solo, and it got much more microscopic. So Trevor was actually on the stage. Honey Baby is in this thing that we created that's kind of womb-like, kind of an industrial womb. And so that piece is called Honey Baby. And I should have brought it here, but anyway, it's a beautiful 15-minute...
Next time. So yeah. I think we have time for one more question, Adrian.
First of all, thank you so much for being here. This is absolutely wonderful. And you've talked a great deal about the creativity that goes into the work that you do as a choreographer. And we as audience members come here and we're absolutely transported by these beings who do things that we can't imagine doing with our bodies.
Isn't that wild?
And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about what goes on in what is an average day for one of your dancers? What enables them to be able to do that in the evening show?
Yeah. Wow, what a great question. Sheer stupidity. they dedicate their life. That's a really sweet question. They dedicate their life to studying and honing their body and developing their physical instrument. It's, you know, if you think of a musician polishing and tuning up, you know, they take from yoga to ballet to Alexander technique to whatever it is that they're working on to fine tune the articulation of their body. And in my work, it's about the conscious direction of energy through the body and out into space. So it takes a certain amount of control and letting go. So they do a lot of things to let go as well. And I think an average day for them is they get up, some of them do train other people for a living or do something before a rehearsal, go to yoga class or something like that. They show up. I don't teach them a class in New York because I don't really have the time to do that in New York, but they have a half hour to warm up on their own. Whatever it is they need to do, a lot of them lie on balls and rollers and they'll do a ballet bar and, you know, whatever. I personally go and do interval training or swim and then do some kind of meditation to mobilize energy through my body, and then I show up at rehearsal. And then we rehearse we only work four days a week because that's what I could afford to pay them. So they come in at 12, at 12:30 rehearsal starts, and then we work like maniacs. We do in 4 hours what most other companies do in 8 hours because that's the limitation of the finances in New York. And so we work on, you know, we pack it in. There's no sitting down. We're always working on some problem or reconstructing something from the past or looking for something from the future. And that goes on and on. And a lot of times I don't tell them what I'm looking for. I teach them movement and then throw them into a disorienting problem that will not allow them to answer the question rationally that I'm asking. And so there's lots of accidents and not bad accidents, but good accidents that we try to recreate. The work looks spontaneous. And then they run off at 4 o'clock and they work at the hairdresser salon or they go to the bank or they back to the gym to train somebody else. And then they go home and then most of them have to take care of their more childish spouses than they are. And if they're lucky, they get to see a movie or a dance concert. And then it starts all over again.
A day in the life of the dancer. Well, yeah. Before we thank Stephen for how much we've enjoyed this, I want to say that the next speaker in the series, media scholar Henry Jenkins, the Provost Professor of Communication, Journalism, and Cinematic Arts at the University of Southern California, will be with us on Thursday, May 1st, and following our thanks to Stephen, we'll be out in the lobby where you can talk to Stephen and enjoy a little bit of reception. But I just now want to thank you for all that you've given us, and we look so forward to Friday evening. At least some of us are going to have that chance.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.
It's fun.
Great. See you out in the lobby.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.